study?
Okay, good afternoon to you all. Thank you for turning up. I know it's a long weekend and many of our students have taken off. But thanks to those who were diligent enough to attend. So we have today with us a very distinguished speaker, and I'm very glad that we're actually kick-starting the year with welcoming Professor Graham Dutfield, who's been really one of the pioneers in the scholarship on traditional knowledge and protection writing before it became the buzzword that we know of it as today, before WIPO started speaking of it, before a number of scholars started speaking of it. Graham worked quite extensively with another intellectual stalwart, Daryl Posey at Oxford, to really give the subject some traction. He's actually also one of the very few practicing interdisciplinary IP scholars that I know of. Not too surprising, given that his background is quite diverse as well. He's got his degrees in Latin American studies and in environment and development studies.
All sorts of things,
yeah. All sorts of things. And so he brings that richness into his scholarship as well, not focusing on IP in the mainstream way that we know of, but really focusing on IP and development from a variety of different perspectives, sociological, anthropological, et cetera, et cetera. Graham's a professor of international governance at Leeds University School of Law, and Leeds has just started their LLM as well, so you can speak to Pooja here a little later if they have time, because they have a flight at 6:45, so we have to make sure they leave here latest by 5:15, 5:30. Graham's also associated with the Oxford Intellectual Property Research Center, the Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto, and one of the IP centers in Wuhan, China. He has several books to his credit. He's a very prolific scholar. He writes way too much. He's got several books and several articles ranging on a variety of IP-related topics. And today he's really going to speak to us on traditional knowledge and pharmaceutical innovation stroke patents, which I sense from the abstract of his talks that one of the issues that he really wants to throw up is the fact that a lot of pharmaceutical companies today miss the opportunity to really look at traditional knowledge, given that in the yesteryears of pharmaceutical innovation, a number of drugs really came out of traditional herbals and traditional knowledge. Aspirin is a brilliant example, which came from the willow bark. And Graham's also going to turn around and ask if the traditional knowledge holders today get their fair dues when this knowledge is really picked up and then converted to products that are then sold in the mainstream marketplace. So I won't say much more on this, but leave it to really Graham to expound on this, and we'll look forward to some interesting questions and an interesting debate at the end of it. Thank you very much, Graham.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for that very generous introduction. It's really good to be here. My first time in the city. I've been to India actually about six times. I've actually counted. Six times. So I know India fairly well. In fact, some of my doctoral research was done. My field work was done. I call it field work. It's mostly in offices. In Delhi in the year 2000, about 9 years ago. That was true about 2 weeks ago. Now it's 10 years ago. Doesn't time fly? Now I come from Leeds University, which perhaps is not that well known to you. It's up in the north of England. It's not that far from London. We're a small country, so it's, you get to London, back to the civilized world, in 2.25 hours. Actually, I'm joking, because we're actually the second biggest law centre in the UK. So we're very much part of the rest of the UK. We're not a backwater somewhere out in the sticks, we say. So the reason why I've chosen the subject is partly because I do know a little bit about it, but also because I think it is a very hot topic. I'm in India, and certainly sort of young lawyers in this country who have an interest in patents or general interest in the law, perhaps, may find that this area I'm going to talk about becomes an essential part of your professional life. But at the very least, I think it's of a lot of academic interest, whether or not the particular details of what I talk about will go with you beyond this particular presentation. Okay, so I'm really talking about modern drugs and traditional knowledge. Right. What do the two have to do with each other? I said modern here and then traditional there. And what I'm going to do anyway is to bring the two together so that they become part of the same conversation. Now, the way I'll organise my talk is to first pose two questions, and then I'll see how, how well I can do in answering the two questions. All right. The first question is this: is traditional knowledge important in drug discovery? When I say drug discovery, I'm talking here about so-called modern pharmaceuticals, not talking about herbal treatments, etc. The second: does patent law help drug companies to claim possession of traditional knowledge? That's a slightly vague sort of terminology here, but what I'm trying to encourage you to think about is that while patent law is supposed to protect inventions that are new and that are inventive, it might be the case that patents may also claim traditional knowledge within their scope, something that presumably shouldn't be possible, but is it actually possible? Okay, so let me deal with the first question. Now, there are two sort of common responses, perhaps at the two extremes, right? Responses to the question, is TK important in drug discovery? Right, the first common assumption, let's say, is yes, definitely very important, right? And the alternative extreme is to say, well, maybe in the past, it may be important in the past, but the science has advanced, and these days, scientists, chemists can make anything in the lab, so surely we just don't need traditional knowledge anymore. There's enough creativity to go on without having to go back to to people living in the rainforests and the and farmers' fields in remote parts of the world. We don't need that anymore. Okay, now I've just put forward first my answer, my somewhat sort of convoluted answer. You find that the older academics get, the more sort of convoluted the answers are, because you find that there are so many shades of grey in life, and so many shades of grey there are in terms of academic argument. First, I would say TK is too important, but not as much as some people say, and not as little as other people say. So, yes, it is important, but we can still debate and dispute the level, the degree of importance. Second, the potential of TK has not been fully explored, despite what many people think. But realising that potential is extremely difficult. It's one thing to say it's important, it's another thing to suggest it's easy to make money out of it, to make new drugs out of it. It's not a simple matter. Because traditional knowledge really primarily has value for local people. Small, incremental, but very important value. Most of it does not have any wider commercial, industrial, or scientific value. Some of it does. Some of it, a lot. Very valuable. Now, what I always tell students is that as scholars, young scholars, what I say is not gospel. You have to come up with your own answers on the basis of the evidence and your interpretation of the evidence and your own reasoning. What I tell my own students, you get no points for agreeing with me. Right? I don't need you to agree with me. I'm quite happy for you to present a totally different point of view. As long as actually you have the evidence and the reasoning, the persuasive reasoning, to support your argument, that's what we're looking for. I'm sure you'll talk the same here as well, but it's worth highlighting, I sometimes think. And none of us, however grey our hair is, necessarily has the definitive answer to so many important questions. And you know, we always have to be willing to change our minds in the light of fresh evidence. Right, now, okay, I'll just go back, I'll just stay with this for a moment. Now, I said earlier, or I did imply earlier, that it is possible to overestimate the importance of TK. It's also possible to underestimate the importance of TK. And on what basis might it be true that the value is underestimated or overestimated? I'm going to look at some, put forward a few points here. Now, first, okay, why is the importance of TK likely to be understated or underestimated by many people? Well, one reason, I think, why people may tend to be inclined to underestimate the value of TK is that as new chemical entities continue to be hard to find, scientists often go back to earlier chemicals to try and find something new about them, right? And you see, the industry is going through a period where their research costs are constantly rising, but what the rewards they get in terms of entirely new chemicals, right, is actually quite not as
sorry.
Sorry, I tend to move around while I'm talking. It's not a problem. Not quite as fruitful as they're hoping. So, in fact, the number of genuinely new drugs entering the market these days is relatively low compared to past decades. Right? It's harder and harder to really come up with genuinely new drugs. And in consequence, a lot of companies are starting to invest in the obviously lower cost, to invest in looking at old products to see if they have certain properties that they weren't aware of before. An example is aspirin, okay, which we're still finding out new things about aspirin. Why? Because people are looking at commercial possibilities. Another example, which you may not be so well aware of, is a dye called methylene blue, right, which was discovered about 100 years ago by Paul Ehrlich in Germany. He discovered the dye, and scientists are again looking at methylene blue to see whether it could be from the basis of an anti-malarial drug. So that's one reason why people may be inclined to incorrectly, perhaps, underestimate the importance of TK. The second is that what I call the learning trails from initial find to a product or a class of products are hard to trace in many cases. The TK origins of so-called new drugs may become forgotten. Right. Now, sometimes I go to meetings with historians of science who are very, so often very interesting people, and I try to do a little bit of science history myself, and I find it very interesting how you can look back at the history of modern drugs and find out how far back the origins actually go, much further back than many people think. Because, you know, I don't know if you read much sort of this kind of literature, but it's very often said that it takes about 10 to 12 years to develop a drug from the initial discovery, right? We're often told that. And I would say that is a little bit misleading. Because it can take 100 years, it can take 200 years, it can take even longer. All right. Now, it's correct if we're talking about a research program by one company on a certain chemical. But if you look at the bigger picture, we find actually, you know, the learning trails are very complicated, actually, in so many cases. Third is that the modern use may be completely different, leading us to forget where the initial lead came from. You know, a lot of plants used in traditional medicine turn out to have commercial value, but not in relation to the disease for which they are used by traditional healers, but something completely different. You know, if something acts on the body in one way, it can act on the body in a number of ways that are not so easy to discern. And you may well find out, as I showed in point one, interesting things about things that are already quite well known. There's always something new to find out. And fourth, sometimes it's just too early to tell. And I every time, I think Pooja has heard this talk of me about five times now this week. She's probably getting a bit tired of it. the former Prime Minister of China, Chiang Wen-Lai, who was when during the period of Chairman Mao, he was asked about the French Revolution. Was it a good thing or a bad thing? His answer was, it's too early to tell. Right. So in the same way, drugs do have a history, and that history can be so long, and forcing one to conclude that actually, we have to, just because it's a TK lead is not leading to a drug for 10 to 20 years, it doesn't mean, therefore, it is actually useless, right? There's what economists talk about, so option value, preserving something just in case it may turn out to be useful. And that's a good reason to protect TK is that there is this, we have to find a way to give policy weight to option value. It is worth preserving, not just, primarily for the local people themselves, but because it can have value much, much later on. Now, why might people overestimate the importance of TK? Well, one, people are bound to assume that because it was important in the past, it will remain important. And while that may be true, it doesn't necessarily follow. It's logically, it's not a valid thing to say. To conclude that because it was, it still is. We don't know. We can't be sure. We can't prove it. Maybe true, but we can't be sure. Second, so-called biopiracy scares have attracted more attention than is warranted. Sometimes, okay, I mean, lots of these scares where you hear about the patenting of traditional knowledge or of a plant that's well known, usually by an American company, and it sounds very, very bad. And sometimes it is bad. Sometimes, if you really closely examine these cases, they're not necessarily quite as bad as they look. I'm not actually defending them, meaning to say that you have to judge each so-called biopiracy case on its own merits. Because sometimes newspapers can be a bit sensationalist, and so even some NGOs can be also a bit sensationalist, and perhaps exaggerate the badness of what may be just a normal business practice. And third, there is, in some quarters, a tendency to be romantic, I think, about indigenous people, traditional communities, and to perhaps sometimes demonise, rather unfairly attack the big drug corporations. Well, I have sometimes said quite some critical things about drug companies, but they are in the business of making money. They do provide tremendous health benefits for human beings, for all of us. Sometimes their practices are not as decent as they should be, but we're better off with them than without them, I would say. Okay, now I've mentioned the word evidence two or three times, so how about some evidence? Right. This is a study done about 20 years ago. It's quite old, and I don't know if the guy who did this research has done any follow-up work. He's called Norman Farnsworth, the University of Illinois, in Chicago, and this is quite well-known figures, okay? What he was doing here was trying to figure out how many modern pharmaceuticals have their inspiration or their basis in traditional plant-based medicine, right? And he figured out that 119 drugs, have been or are extracted from higher plants. 190 chemicals from higher plants. And I think in this particular study, he means higher plants that use traditional medicine, right? And of those, about three quarters have related or the same use in traditional medicine as they have in terms of their modern applications. Of course, That sounds quite impressive. That sounds like an interesting figure. Again, I'll pose this question. Does this make TK important in future drug discovery? Now, I've chosen two examples, two things I want to talk about, because I think they do illustrate the past importance of traditional knowledge, but do provide certain lessons which may imply that we're not we should still think of TK as an important source of ideas, inspiration, of material for new drugs. So I'm going to talk at first about aspirin. Now we all know what aspirin is, but we don't necessarily all know the story of aspirin and the importance of aspirin in any discussion about traditional knowledge and its relevance to modern medicine. Now, aspirin has in fact been known about. Aspirin, as Professor Bashir mentioned, coming from the bark of the willow tree, it has been known about for 7,000 years as a treatment of some kind or another. The Middle East, ancient Egypt. But it's, as far as I know, the first recording of its use, of uses that are the same as they are now, come from ancient Greece and Rome, where it was used as an analgesic anti-inflammatory agent, including that's recorded by the famous doctor called Galen, who was the doctor of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor. If you've seen that film Gladiator, Marcus Aurelius, he dies in the first scene, right? Aspirin was no help in that particular occasion. All right, now, 100 years later, it was rediscovered. This was basically forgotten, but it was rediscovered. Now, why is that interesting? Interesting because its rediscovery was also inspired by the traditional knowledge of the time. All right. Now, philosophers of science, right, will tell you this. They will tell you that many discoveries, important discoveries that are true, that are correct, are inspired by incorrect or bad theories. You can still get to a success, even though your theory is completely wrong. All right. Now, one of the theories that was prevalent among scientists at that time, or as they were called, natural philosophers, and particularly those who were interested in nature and in health, was the so-called doctrine of signatures. Now, the doctrine of signatures, and this particular idea perhaps is not very different from India, is that, among other things, is that God makes the world and leaves signs around. And those signs are, and the good scientist is the one who is able to detect these signs. Right? Now, an obvious sign, very obvious sign, comes from looking at the walnut. Now, a walnut, if you haven't noticed, I'm sure we all looked at a walnut sometime, rather than our lives, looks a bit like a human brain, doesn't it? Right? So, that leads to the belief that eating walnuts is good for the brain. Okay, well that's a very obvious one. You don't have to be that clever to think that. And of course, it's just pure chance, I'm sure. But a less obvious one, but again, perhaps an interesting one, and I say particularly, a number of people I've talked to this week have nodded their heads as if they say, okay, we're not unfamiliar with this idea, is that the source of a cure of a disease comes from the same place, or it's the same place, as the source of the disease itself. So if you're seeking a cure to a disease, you go to the source of the disease, and then there you will find the cure. Right. So that was Edward Stone's thinking when he was seeking a cure for malaria, or for what they called the ague in that time, which is just basically fever. It included malaria. Now he knew that malaria that the diseases seem to be prevalent in marshy areas, swampy lands, right? Now, we all know that, don't we? The mosquito larvae that transmit malaria, the larvae grow on surface water. But he was also inspired by the traditional knowledge not of England or Europe, or even of India, but of South America, particularly Peru. And he was aware, as people were at the time, that the only treatment for malaria at the time, which was quinine, difficult to find and expensive in England at the time, came from the bark of a tree that grows in Peru, in South America, right? The cinchona tree. So he put together these two insights, or these two ideas. One is that, you know, you go and look in swampy areas and bark of a tree. So let's try some tree barks. So he tried another tree bark, and one of which was the willow. He sucked it on the willow. It tasted bitter, just like quinine, right? So he produced an extract and tried it on a few people and found it did work on mild fevers. And actually published that article in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the first still existing academic law journal. Now, that led to a number of a certain amount of research and testing, but by the 1850s, in Europe, particularly France and Germany, and England as well, people were getting quite good at chemistry, right? And be able to find out what chemicals are made of, right? And also be able to modify chemicals to turn it into something similar but with different, more useful properties. So during the latter part of the 19th century, a number of different teams of scientists were modifying the active chemical, the active ingredient of what we now call aspirin, right? And among those scientists, there are three at Bayer. Now, Bayer, the German company, the German chemical firm, which was at the time a dye firm that was moving into medicines. They produced a modified version, which was less harmful for the stomach and a bit more potent. And they got the patent. They patented it in the United States and the UK, right? A 7,000-year-old product, in a sense, but patented in 1899. Now, so clearly there is a TK inspiration. The traditional knowledge had quite a lot to do with the existence of aspirin, right? But that's not really the end of the story, because aspirin led to the development of a whole class of drugs, not just aspirin, but a whole class of drugs which sought to produce the same or better therapeutic effects. And these are what some people call the NSAIDs, which are the non-steroidal, so what can we say, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Okay, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, of which paracetamol and ibuprofen are two well-known examples. But not only that, I should point this out, is that very often it's the case that although we know that a chemical does have a therapeutic effect on people, it doesn't mean we know how it works. And once you know how it works, this can lead to many, many new discoveries. Right. And so the way that the mode of action was discovered actually as recently as 1971. But once that was done, had encouraged a great deal more research, right, based on that understanding, which has led to quite a lot of more drugs as well, the so-called COX inhibitors, which were inspired by John Vane working out how aspirin works. And as a consequence, we find new applications for aspirin. We also find many, many new patents, lots of new patents relating to aspirin. So that's a great example. All right, now another example I want to talk about, I'll be a little bit more brief about this one, but this is something called curare, which is a muscle relaxant used in surgery. Now, when I'm talking to students, I often like to give them a few interesting little facts that they wouldn't hear from anybody else, partly because they're not necessarily very useful, but they're still a little bit interesting, okay? You may not be aware that somebody who loves archery is a toxophile. Right? Someone who loves archery is a toxophile. Somebody who studies poisons is a toxologist. Now you may think, why do these two words sound very similar? And the reason why is the origins of toxic or toxin comes from, I think, the Greek word for bow. All right? And the reason why for that connection, strange connection, is because of curare. Right? Now, curare, like so many drugs, is in fact, drugs really are poisons. Drugs, poisons, it's the same thing. It's the context that matters. If a poison kills what's poisoning you before it gets the chance to kill you, it is a medicine. If it kills you before it kills what's killing you, then it is a poison. All right? And so in some ways, drugs actually are poisons. They have side effects. People get killed by drugs, by modern pharmaceuticals. This is why we control drug approval as if it is a dangerous thing. Right? We control. We don't just allow anybody to make a drug and sell it. Right? It is a controlled substance in that sense. Obviously not quite the same way as heroin is controlled. Although, funnily enough, now I mentioned heroin. Back in the 1890s, Bayer, they were thinking, do we market aspirin or heroin, which was trademarked. That's a trademark. Heroin was actually then a trademark because men feel heroic, apparently, when they take it. Weird. But most of the senior scientists, and certainly the head of Bayer at the time, he believed that aspirin is more harmful than heroin, and so he felt that that Bayer ought to actually market heroin rather than aspirin. But after some tests from a patient without his permission, which he's very angry about, the scientists involved did testing about aspirin. They found out it wasn't as harmful as heroin after all. So aspirin is what got on the market, and heroin is, of course, never made the market and was banned. Although it is obviously sold not as heroin, it is sold on its chemical name as a painkiller in hospitals. Obviously a heavily controlled substance, but that's a different story. Okay, right, let's get back on subject here. Now, curare. Now, it is an arrow poison. Right, an arrow poison used by the Indians of South America. Right. Now, poisons have to do, if you're hunting, poisons have to have a number of qualities. One of which is that they must, the poison cannot remain, right, at the time it's being eaten. Right. If you cook it, that must destroy the poison. It helps if the poison has a transient effect. It breaks down as quick as possible. Once it's done its work, right? But they also needed a poison that enabled them, as far as I know. I saw it on TV once, I think, the Discovery Channel, I think it was, or something, about this. they shot, I saw these people actually shooting, they shoot these monkeys off trees, right? Now, if you are, if you're a hunter, and I'm not a hunter, I've never been one, but, you know, I can imagine, if you're a hunter and you happen to like monkeys, which I don't particularly, I like them, but not to eat them, right? But if I did, monkeys live in trees, obviously, quite often, and if you shoot a monkey, which is very difficult to do, you get through branches, the leaves in the way, but if you hit a monkey, you don't want to kill it, right, so you've got to climb the tree and then go retrieve the monkey and bring it down, right? How much better it is for that monkey's muscles to relax and just fall out the tree. Right. So this arrow poison karate does allow it has the effect of making the monkey's muscles relax as it dies. Actually, it doesn't actually die at the time. It's sort of paralysed and it just falls. Right, okay, well, it does die eventually, quite soon after. Now, the particular properties of karate did attract the interest of a number of people in a number of parts of the world, particularly in Europe. And a man called Dr. Brodie in London decided to do some tests on karate. I hope this isn't boring. I do tend to talk a lot about things that interest me. All right, okay, but I'll carry on. Now, he did this test on a donkey, all right? A donkey, right, okay. Now, so he gave this donkey an injection of karate. The donkey, it just collapsed, it paralyzed. Now, rather than just say, oh, okay, it paralyzes donkeys, he decided to cut the trachea and actually ventilate the donkey, right? So the donkey was getting air, right? And after a while, the donkey woke up and recovered, made a full recovery and lived for several years after, right? So what did this show? Okay, it shows that while it had a transient effect, right? And also that while it will kill by itself, if you actually ventilate the lungs, it will paralyze without causing death. See, it does affect all the muscles, but it does particularly affect the muscles that you need to breathe. It didn't take very long. Actually, no, it did take very long. Well, it's basically 130 years, a long time. Actually, I would now. Going forward, exactly 130 years, various insights were put together and to show that if you administer karate with an anaesthetic and you ventilate the patient, it is extremely useful in surgery for relaxing muscles, particularly in abdominal operations, because even though you're anaesthetic, your muscles start to tighten up, apparently, inside your body. So it actually it makes surgery very dangerous. So this actually made surgery a lot safer. Right. Not only that, as with aspirin, research both on karate and research with karate has led to many, many interesting insights into the way the body works, particularly the way the body chemistry works, and has also led to the development of several new medicines, including Prozac, as it happens. I've actually just been reading a book called From Karate to Prozac, where I learned some of this. Okay, that's then, but what about now? All right. Well, again, some evidence. Now, one thing I've found in doing my recent research is that there's so much information you will not get from law journals, unfortunately. And sometimes looking at science and other journals will actually get you the information that you want to find. Now, because one keeps hearing from industry, we don't need plants anymore, we don't need traditional knowledge in this stuff, I thought I'd try and find some alternative views. And from authoritative people, this is an article by two scientists who work at the National Cancer Institute in the United States, so a very prestigious institution in America, like Gordon Craig and David Newman. This is what they said, that natural products play a dominant role, and I stress the word dominant, a dominant role in the discovery of leads for the development of drugs for the treatment of human diseases. I say leads because what you end up with may be completely different, right? And obviously, to go from a TK lead to a product involves a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of creativity, further creativity from scientists to get there, right? But it does play a dominant role in the discovery of LEADS. And they looked at various therapeutic groups, including cancer, among other things. One example that they did give of a fairly direct connection, right? A fairly direct connection from healer, information from a native healer to a drug product is this one, hemoxin, which is a treatment for sickle cell anemia. Right. So clearly, nature continues to be important. It doesn't itself mean that TK is important because, we're not necessarily talking about plants that anybody knows about much about. But clearly, by giving an example, we can show that sometimes traditional knowledge holders can provide lots of information, some of which may well enable you to shortcut that discovery process. Okay, perhaps a more high-profile example of a product in the present day, an old product and yet also a new product, is artemisinin, which is comes produced by the so-called wormwood. It is an anti-malarial. It is currently where used a modified version in combination with other products is now the most effective anti-malarial treatment we have now. It was recorded in the 4th century. Right, the 4th century. Since then, we have to go forward well over 1,000 years, to testing and discovery of the active compound. We still don't know exactly how it works, but even so, numerous patents are being filed that relate to artemisinin. Numerous patents are being filed, and once we have figured out the mode of action, it's very likely the patenting is going to go up markedly. Okay, so I think I've dealt with the first question. So I said, well, what about the second question? Does patent law help drug companies claim possession of traditional knowledge, something that presumably patent law shouldn't really allow, should it? Okay, first, again, some evidence of figures to see how much patenting actually is going on. Now, this is a paper, again, not in a law journal, in the Journal of Economics, by Marinova and Raven. How much patenting activity is going on? It's assumed that there is lots and lots of patenting activity going on relating to TK, but how much really is? Well, apparently, according to this, quite a lot. Right? There has been an increase in both absolute numbers as a proportion of all patents being granted at the US Patent and Trademark Office. This was found out by doing a sort of keyword search, right? Including quite a lot of patents based on properties of neem and turmeric. Right, quite a lot. It's more than most people might think. Surprisingly high figure. Now, that term relating to, I would ask you to think about that because relating to can mean a number of things. Right, relating to. Right, what does relating to actually mean? Okay. Now, so. How could TK form the basic subject matter of a patent invention? How could TK be included within what is being claimed as a new invention? How could that be possible? Right? And this needs some close examination. But I think there are about four possible ways to answer that question. Four ways you could answer that question. One way to answer that question is to say that the invention described in the patent is actually an inventive step beyond the TK, right? So maybe it's not quite the same. There is an improvement. So, and the same way as you hear so many times of arguments about patents, this one and that one, well, is this one really inventive in light of what we already know or what is disclosed in the earlier patent? Often it's the case that, in fact, if you examine it closely, there is a difference, there is an inventive step. In which case, presumably, there's nothing wrong, unless you may have some ethical concerns perhaps, but legally there's nothing actually wrong with that. Second, it may be the case that the patent was granted in error. Well, patent examiners can't possibly have access to all of the prior art. You know, however efficient a patent office is, right, however efficient it is, you know, there are certain things that are bound to slip through the net, you know, that it's not a perfect filtering system, right? No matter how comprehensive a database is of prior art, some things will get missed. And I know that the Indian government has particularly sought to deal with this problem by producing a traditional knowledge digital library, the TKDL, traditional knowledge digital library, which they're making available to patent granting offices to make sure that that so-called inventions that relate a bit too closely to the traditional knowledge of India are not granted by mistake. The third is that perhaps the patent was granted legally despite its similarity to the TK, but there are certain rules or loopholes in the law that still make it legal. And to give you a good example of this, some of you may be aware, back in the 1990s, there's a patent granted in the United States on the use of turmeric in wound healing. Now, that patent was challenged and was revoked on the basis of a lack of novelty, right? But what evidence had to be provided to show that it wasn't new? What evidence was admissible and what wasn't? And in fact, the United States is a little different from Europe, also different from India, right? Because in India and in Europe, we both have a relatively straightforward interpretation of novelty, right? And of lack of novelty, perhaps, I should say. In the sense that if something is known about or used anywhere in the world already, you can't patent it. It's not novel anymore. And in whatever form it is known, whether it's known in oral form, whether it's written down, it doesn't matter. So the fact that millions of Indian people know and even use turmeric in wound healing doesn't matter, all right? The important thing is, was that knowledge written down? And so the law firm that was hired to take this case to get the patent re-examined in the US the patent office had to, it was no use them saying, sort of recording people saying, oh yeah, we all know about turmeric, as a wound healing agent. That was no use. They had to provide things like journal articles, books, etc. Right? That's what they had to provide. Doesn't seem very fair, does it really? I mean, it's why should you limit in geography the concept of novelty? Or lack of novelty. United States is a bit old-fashioned in that way, right? Funny enough, in Europe, in the UK, until 1977, novelty was only determined by what was known or used in the UK. So if it was 7,000 years old knowledge in India, it didn't matter if no one knew that in the UK. Right. So, but we've changed. The United States has sort of not made the complete transition to the modern world. Say I a little bit cheekily. The practice in that sense is a little bit archaic. But there's no way they'll change it. Complain as much as you like, there's no way they'll change it. Right, now fourth, and this is where it gets, I think, interesting. And this is a bit more kind of speculative, right? Is it the case that patent law gives rights to those who can translate ritual or spiritual knowledge, or knowledge expressed in a spirit in a sort of ritualistic or spiritual terminology, into the language of science? Whether or not this translation requires much inventive input, or that any new thing is actually created. In other words, if an anthropologist goes to a healer, and the healer tells the anthropologist about a plant, explains how to produce a healing agent out of that plant, and describes it, but does it in a way that mentions God, the spirit of the plant, or whatever. Okay, so in very ritualistic or spiritual terms, all right? If that anthropologist then describes the same process, the same effect in a scientifically acceptable language, is that enough to get a patent, to claim an invention? Right. That's an interesting question, an intriguing question. Right. Surely it shouldn't do. Surely that shouldn't be enough. But it's a question that I've been thinking about for a little while. But the reason why I thought about the question is that a very senior patent judge in the UK called Lord Hoffman used an example of TK in order, as an analogy, in order to assess whether a patent was novel or describe a new invention or not. Right. And so, and I, first, before I talk about this about what he said, this is a case which is called Merrill Dow versus Norton in 1996, the House of Lords in the UK. Okay, Merrill Dow versus Norton. Now, this case wasn't ostensibly about TK, it was actually about a medicine. Now, it's important perhaps to, in this context, to be aware that drug companies, when they always fear the expiry of a patent protecting the basic chemical, which is obviously the drug. Because once it's expired, obviously anybody can make the drug. And so they would like to find ways to extend their monopoly after that that patent expires. And one way they can do that is to patent the so-called metabolite. Now, what often happens in the human body, right, when you take a drug, is that your body converts it into something else, right? So the drug reacts with your body and it is converted into another chemical, which is the one that has the therapeutic effect. Now, drug companies will not stop doing research on a drug just because it entered the market. They will continue to do research because they're still trying to find out new things about that drug, which hopefully they can patent. If that drug is a valuable one, if it does make money, not all drugs make much money. If it does, it's worth doing the extra research to see if you extend the monopoly one way or another. And so this patent, the patent in question, was a second patent, a patent on the metabolite, which is the transformed chemical, so that once the drug on the product, which is terfenadine, once that expires, then the next patent sort of kicks in a sense, and you keep on with your monopoly. So Lord Hoffman had to decide whether the first patent effectively revealed or disclosed the information claimed in a second patent. Right, because as he said, a patent is a piece of information. That's actually what he said. And so as a common law judge will do in these kind of situations, or should do, they will try to reason by analogy. They will try and think of something that is different, right, but that has some certain features in common, and think, well, in order to help them to understand the present kind of issues that they're meant to be dealing with. If they're common issues or common features, then it can help to explain and to understand a rather sort of complex matter. Obviously, it wasn't a simple matter, and he had to reason very hard about this. And so he decided to use the analogy of quinine, right? So this is what he said. I just narrowed down what he said to the most important points. The first slide is just basically a sort of descriptive presentation. He said this. He said that the Amazon Indians have known for centuries that cinchona bark can be used to treat malarial and other fevers. They're used in the form of powdered bark. In 1820, French scientists discovered that the active ingredient, an alkaloid called quinine, could be extracted and used more effectively in the form of sulfate of quinine. In 1944, the structure of the alkaloid molecule was discovered. This meant the substance could be synthesized. All right. So we go from knowledge, going back a long time, discovering that ingredient, and then obviously using it in a new form. Does the Indian know about quinine? Well, under the description of the quality of the bark, which makes it useful for treating fevers, he obviously does. I don't think it matters that he chooses to label it in animistic rather than chemical terms. He knows that the bark has a quality which makes it good for fever, and that is one description of quinine. On the other hand, in a different context, the Amazon Indian would not know about quinine. If shown pills of quinine sulfate, he would not associate them with the cinchona bark. He doesn't know quinine under the description of a substance in the form of pills, and he certainly would not know about the artificially synthesized alkaloid. All right, okay. So, different ways of knowing. All right. Which are not necessarily mutually intelligible. Because, of course, the defense of the alleged infringer in this case, the defense was that actually the first patent was anticipated with, by description, the second patent, right? Even though it wasn't necessarily described in the chemical terms, because the metabolite, the chemical formula, was not actually given in the first patent. In fact, the alleged infringers, obviously, you know, they were sort of counterclaiming that patent was the second patent was granted when it shouldn't have been. So he says the quinine example shows that there are descriptions under which something may, in a relevant sense, be known without anyone being aware of its chemical composition, or even that it has an identifiable molecular structure. This proposition is unaffected by whether the substance is natural or artificial. Then he gets really to the rub here. Do the same principles apply in law of patents? Or does patent law have a specialized epistemology of its own? Now, if you're like me, you'll struggle with the meaning of a term like specialized epistemology. So let me try and help you with what he means by this term. All right. Now, the counsel for the patent holders argued, he's called, now called Mr. Thorley, by the way. Mr. Thorley argued that to show that the invention had already been described earlier and therefore wasn't actually novel, the anticipation or the prior description, the prior invalidating description, must be provided in the language of chemistry. That's what he claimed. And because the first patent did not describe the metabolite in the language of chemistry, then the patent was valid because it was new. And in the words of Lord Hoffman again, Mr. Thorley says that for a substance to be known, such to be part of the state of the art, it must be known by its chemical composition. No other description will do. Right. Now, Lord Hoffman rejected this argument. Right. It doesn't matter how you describe the invention. It doesn't matter how, in what form it may have been described in the past. If you follow the description and you get the same result at the end, you have practiced the invention. And it doesn't matter that that description was not in the language of science, of chemistry or biology. It doesn't matter. For practical purposes, it doesn't matter. And you know, the patent system is about practice, about commerce, about money. Right? That's what the patent system is about. Right? And it doesn't matter. You're able to work to enable the invention by what was described in the first patent. So therefore, it wasn't an invention. Right? Now, my interpretation of what Lord Hoffman says, and one may actually dispute some of the final points of my interpretation of what he said, his ruling in this case. Of course, the patent did not survive this case. It takes a good patent to survive Lord Hoffman. and this wasn't very good. Okay. So I would say, okay, on the basis of what Lord Hoffman says, you can patent something old and previously used, and made available to the public, if it wasn't known about under any enabling form of description. Okay, that's slightly twisted in a way, but that I think that's true. You see, if you take traditional knowledge and describe the same thing in chemical terms, it's not enough, right? But it is enough that if that traditional knowledge was not enabling, it didn't lead to quite the same result. Right? Now, then it becomes two different things. You're describing two different things. Therefore, the first description does not make the second one in the patent lack novelty. So otherwise, you can't. Patent law does not have its own epistemology. So there is no language of patents in that sense. Right. Now, so if I'm right in my interpretation, then I think we can say that traditional knowledge holders position is perhaps a bit safer in the UK than it may be in some other parts of the world. Right. However, as any law professor will tell you, an invention's novelty or a patent validity relating to a particular invention may be decided in different ways in different jurisdictions. So a patent found to be valid in one court in one country may be found to be invalid in a high court in another country. You know, the Supreme Court of Germany may uphold a patent. The House of Lords or Supreme Court in the UK may decide completely differently. And in fact, in Germany and United States, the same patented invention did survive challenges in those courts. Now, unfortunately, I can't read German, and I would actually like to read to find out the reasoning of the court. The US decision, I haven't read it yet, so maybe I should make it my point to actually read it. although it doesn't necessarily mean that I'd be any the wiser for reading it in terms of what I'm trying to argue here. But it may well be the case that Lord Hoffman's view would not be accepted or be followed in another jurisdiction. So it may well be the case that this kind of translation may be sufficient to get a patent in various other jurisdictions. It would be sufficient to pass the non-obviousness test, or the inventor step test. It may be sufficient to pass the novelty test. The question perhaps I should leave you with is that right or not? Just to wrap up, I think because you're all, you know, here we are in India, and I think it's very interesting that India has really been in the forefront of sort of leading this debate at the international level. But also India has been willing to put its money where its mouth is, in a sense, not only by producing the database of such knowledge, but also by actually providing measures, not just in the Patent Act, but also in the Biodiversity Act as well, to try and give the patent system what you might call a sort of human face in this respect, by introducing certain measures that would deal with this issue to ensure that traditional knowledge doesn't get unfairly misappropriated through the patent system, so that the patent system does protect only genuine inventions. And as this discussion goes on, India and Brazil, a number of other countries, particularly developing countries, have managed to get this issue taken very seriously at the highest level. And whether or not we have some kind of international treaty which does ensure that the unfair use of TK is prevented, it's quite possible that we will get something, however satisfactory the final result actually is. Every treaty is a compromise, and I doubt if India will get exactly what it wants, but it may at least get some of what it wants. At that point, I think I'll stop and invite you to ask any questions you might have, or any comments. All right, thank you.
Any questions?
Hey, let me start then.
Okay, yes.
I mean, on Hoffman's decision,
yeah,
in Merrill Dow.
Yes.
So, I perceive as presenting, I mean, there could be several alternatives to the way he went about reasoning, you know, the way he did it. And given that, I think he made a distinction between previous use versus previous description.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Documentation, and I think.
Yeah.
And as you rightly mentioned, the U.S. does not recognize international use as
right.
something that can anticipate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you haven't used it in the U.S., you could get a patent there. But if he sort of stress on use, and the U.K. stresses on use, India, you know, looks at prior use anywhere in the world as well. Then I think it may offer a better deal to TK communities that at least want to ensure that their knowledge is not appropriated as a patent later. I mean, that's just one part of the debate. So because I see use as quite distinct from written description. So in the case of the Bach, if you've used it, it doesn't matter whether you know what exactly contributed to the specific use and then to the impact. And so somebody extracts an active ingredient and then uses it for the same purpose. Then I assume it comes much closer to finding an anticipation. Whereas Hoffman's judgment, I think, turns more on the written description. That is, if you haven't sort of enabled it in a way that a man of science can understand it, and, you know, through the literature, then of course, you know, we might think of giving you a patent on novelty. That's one part of the question. And the second part is, really, that in a lot of these cases, I think novelty is a tricky issue. But apart from novelty, even the discovery exception becomes a little tricky. And, you know, because I mean, if I see this as, you know, this already existed in nature, all you're doing is you're extracting an active ingredient that again exists in nature, and you know, I mean, the big farce that most of these patent jurisdictions pull off is that they say, well this is, you know, you make it in the lab now, so it's artificial. Mm. It has the same natural function.
Yeah.
It's artificial.
Yeah.
Well, if it's artificial, then the patent right must be restricted to that artificiality. And the moment I go back to the natural thing, or I combine it with something else, then the patent right shouldn't cover it.
Yeah.
Right. So So one aspect is, you know, on novelty itself, where we can stress on prior use. One aspect is if we stress on the discovery exception and give it a meaningful interpretation, then again that reduces the chances of patents being taken out on something that might actually originate in nature. And thirdly, you know, I think a lot of these things, if we really apply non-obviousness seriously, would get knocked off, because, you know, if from a natural plant, I mean, you would say it's an obvious thing to look for the active ingredient. Mm-hmm. If I know that, you know, traditional communities are using a plant, and in India most of Ayurveda, you know, relies on herbals, relies really on use of naturally existing material.
Yeah.
And if I know that that is useful for a certain medical purpose, then my first step is always to try and see what the active ingredient is. And once someone in the community, the scientific community, tells me that, you know, if I want to look for an active ingredient, there are, you know, five different ways I look for it. So the process is supposedly known, method of extracting, and then I just identify the active ingredient. So, you know, why should there be a patent just on thing, right? So we don't need to get bogged down with the sort of novelty issues. We go straight into inventive step and we say, let's not invent it, because, you know, all you've done is, yes, the active ingredient may not have been known to a traditional community. They may just know the bark. They don't know what in the bark. They think it's the spirit of the bark, but the spirit of the bark, the scientist says, is, you know, XYZ chemical composition.
Well, it might be possible to argue perhaps quite strongly that, you know, his judgment would provide a certain amount of safety in a few cases, but only a few cases, perhaps, you know. And I think that's a reasonable point to make. Of course, you actually made a few points there. Let me see if I can sort of deal with it in a second. Well, of course, in this particular case, he did separate anticipation by use and by description, and which is quite interesting, because what happened in the UK is that the law changed in Act 67, and the old, the new law is that you can infringe by using a patent even though you actually don't know you're doing it. Whereas I think before 1977, the law in the UK was that you had to actually know you know you're doing it. So secret or ignorant use was a defence, but now it isn't a defence. So he looks at use and description, and then, there's two sides to a judgment. I basically deal with one, because he does, of course, you know, what is sort of decisive is that he does say, you know, a patent is basically a piece of information, right? That for him, that was decisive, at least in this case. That's what he really highlights here. So there's a piece of information. Patents aren't always described as such, are they? They aren't necessarily described and information, but that's the way he sort of looks at it. This case does at least clarify in my mind that you do have to do a bit more. It can't just be any new description. It has to be not just an alternative description. It can't just be an alternative description of the same thing. It must go beyond. Now, of course, you know, scientists will say, well, it's synthetic, it's artificial, it's modified, it's different. And that is likely to be a sort of defense that is going to carry the day. One thing I would say about that, and although this, you know, this doesn't necessarily isn't going to make any difference, but it's interesting perhaps to be aware that healers have knowledge about plants, which enable them to know how to use plants, right? Without knowledge, without which those plants would not
be of an interest to drug companies. Now, well, I certainly, because I had a discussion once with a sort of ethnobiologist who used to go to Colombia and do field work there, and he used to tell me that sometimes the only way you can find out about plants is by talking to local indigenous people, right? Because plants are like all living things. Are sort of chemical factories. Obviously, we're human beings, are making chemicals all the time. Every cell in our bodies are sort of making things, making proteins, that DNA, etc. And plants make a certain kind of chemicals called secondary metabolites, secondary compounds, which are actually not involved in metabolism. They're secondary compounds that provide other function than metabolism. And a lot of those have historically been sources of drugs. Now, plants will make these secondary compounds, right, under certain conditions, but not others, right? And this guy, he told me that he would observe these people, they would prepare plants at certain times of the day, right? And then they would use them, right? And they would do some sort of things at some time of the day, and although they're described in ritual terms, there was a practical underlying logic, right? Now, there are plants will produce chemicals in the mornings, but not in the afternoon, evening, at a certain time of day. So they carry out these sort of rituals of collecting and preparing at certain times of the day, right? Which means that, if you are from a drug company and you come in the evening and you go and click the plant, you won't find anything there. It's not there. Although obviously the native people don't know anything about the chemistry of a plant, they do, although they wouldn't describe it in this way, because our sort of language is affected by enlightenment and thinking the scientific revolution, certainly in Europe, which we think of have a sort of mechanical view of life and the world, and so the whole idea of calling a plant a chemical factory was utterly bizarre, but for us in a way it makes sense. So their description would not have any logic to or any meaning to a sort of Western person like me. However, there would be a practical logic there, but just not described in that way. And so without knowing the chemistry of a plant, there may as well still be an enormous amount of knowledge that enables people to exploit certain chemical properties that a scientist coming in would not begin to know how to do, right? However good their chemical knowledge or their botanical knowledge. It would be wrong to assume that because they're not chemists, therefore they don't know how to exploit the chemical properties of plants. Now, how you discuss that in terms of patent law is another matter. But nonetheless, I think one would do well to have some respect for the detail and sophistication of the traditional knowledge of plants when deciding what is a description that is does or does not invalidate or does not destroy novelty of a patent. Sorry, that's an extremely long way to explain. But I wanted to make that point anyway, because I think that is perhaps of some potential significance in terms of patent law and how one deals with this amazing sort of cross-cultural sort of misunderstanding that patent law does sort of present to a lot of traditional people, who perhaps in a way they have this view that sometimes that a patent law gives you a property right that had a direct effect on their livelihoods, and of course it's not really quite the case. But nonetheless, epistemology epistemologically, it does seem to reflect a rather sharp and unreasonable sort of bias in terms of knowledge. Somehow, some knowledge is privileged over another kind of knowledge. How you would deal with that in terms of interpreting the Scott patents is a very interesting question. And I think that Lord Hoffman's judgment at least gives us a start in trying to figure that out. Lord Hoffman is a very well-read person, but he's not not an anthropologist or anything, and that's his. But nonetheless, I think it's an extremely illuminating case that does set it should set what our mind is thinking. Any other questions? Yes.
Figures of 119 chemicals that were extracted from Lyapunov. So these were drugs that came out of these chemicals, or these were just chemicals that were extracted?
These are actual drugs. Drugs. Somewhere, I can give you reference to the article later on if you're interested. But these were chemicals where he actually meant pharmaceutical products, so actual drugs.
And the very question is, I think we have a lot of scope within existing patent law to at least prevent broadly labeling misappropriation of traditional knowledge. Mm. So what we at least broadly agree upon as classic cases of misappropriation, mm-hmm. I think a robust application of patent law principles should really prevent that, along with various other initiatives. You mentioned the TKDL, and TKDL is a classic example, and really it's a very, it's a very simple idea. Mm. The idea is basically that we just want to enable patent examiners to get access to knowledge that they otherwise wouldn't have ready access to.
Yeah.
So all they've done is they've really just taken written descriptions from India, not even used, just written descriptions from India, from ancient texts, converted it into language known to them, which is translated to five different international languages, and then given access to the patent office. Said, we just need to access these databases, and I believe there are already 84 cases where these databases have already started impacting patent applications at the EPO.
Yeah.
So I think from the defensive point of view, the solution may not be as hard as we think it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And getting international consensus on that also might not be that. I guess you'd have to have international consensus that would have the US then strictly apply patent law, which may not be particularly feasible. But the more problematic aspect for TK really is, how do you proactively leverage it? So one aspect is you're just making sure that someone else doesn't misappropriate. But the other aspect of it is, if there are communities in a certain country, and someone at a conference once asked me, we said, why should this knowledge be protected at all in any sense? And we said, if Saudi Arabia has its oil, India and Brazil have their this knowledge. I mean, it's a resource that can potentially bring some kind of wealth for these communities and defend the country. And if you're looking at that dimension, then what would the approach really be? I mean, international consensus then just seems near impossible to me. And you cannot do anything without international consensus here, because you'd run into the same problem that TRIPS was meant to address.
Yeah.
It's a free rider problem. It's a problem that one country does it. So if India starts documenting its traditional knowledge that's not otherwise found in books, but the community comes forward and says, this is what we know, and you document it, That's the biggest mistake you're making without international consensus, because you have a register, you might apply, you might give them some remuneration in your own country if someone uses that knowledge.
Yeah.
But once that register is public, anyone anywhere in the world can use it.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, is it that you're just giving away a free resource of so many potential leads for drug discovery, besides which if the patent law does allow you know a slight does allow you to get a patent based on a rewriting in a sense, a creative rewriting of the prior art of what we already know, then perhaps that is a free gift. While trying to stop free riding, it actually becomes a free gift to free riders. There are two sides to this. So it is potentially it could exacerbate the problem rather than actually solve it. It is a very good point. Of course, you know, I mean, things that people often say is that it's no use in one country doing something without, you know, everyone doing it. On one hand, I would say that if a country thinks traditional is that important, they need to deal with it at national level. You know, pass national laws to protect it. Otherwise, you know, one might say, well, you know, are you serious about this? Does it matter that much to you? If you're talking about, you know, in Geneva, WIPO say we need a treaty, but you're not doing anything at the national level. But of course, one of the things that concern people most is, of course, the international transfer. Transfers of knowledge know absolutely no boundaries anymore. Transfer of logical material, you know, some boundaries, but it's quite easy to shift things around. And is it sufficient? I would say it is necessary, but not sufficient. Necessary to deal at national level with this, but obviously it won't necessarily address all of your concerns.
I think counterproductive. I mean,
yes.
See, again, on the defensive side, if you want to prevent misappropriation, starting off nationally is good. And I think if you look at the example of India, the Patents Act itself contains provisions. Can't take out a patent on something that effectively encapsulates traditional knowledge. You can't, if you use a biological resource, you must disclose it. You must take permission from the biodiversity board. So the number of checks and balances to prevent misappropriation. And that's, you know, if you start, you have to start off nationally with that, because as you rightly say, you can't go international and say, we want an international treaty, and the first thing they want to ask you is, you know, do you have something back home? On what basis are you sort of coming up
with? Yeah.
But you can't do the same thing with, you know, as I mentioned, a proactive approach would mean, you know, several communities. You know, if I look back to my home state, I mean, there's several Ayurvedic massage techniques which are known just to families, several oils, to selective communities, families that are trade secrets. Now, you know, if the country now wants to suddenly get this out. Mm-hmm. Because they think that this kind of knowledge should be out and people should be using it to develop further on products and to innovate further and to make it more widely distributable and for them to find export markets.
Yeah.
Then you need to get that knowledge somewhere where people can see it. And the moment you let Indians see it, there's no way you're going to regulate it only within India. I mean, anyone else can see it.
Yeah.
And if you have protection mechanisms within India, right? I mean, so you have an Indian law that says if this oil is, you know, if you as a family make known this oil, then anyone industrially appropriating this oil will have to pay you, and we work out the royalties, etc. Right? So it's not a patent, really. This is creating a register, because you know, we move outside the patent system and we say that, okay, disclose what you've held up, because the other fear is a lot of this dies out with the family. One of my uncles got this fabulous. When allopathic doctors had given up on his eye infection, you know, which made him really go blind, he found this Ayurvedic guy who, you know, it's a herbal concoction, gave it to him, and he was cured overnight. His son had the same problem, went back, but the guy passed away. Right? So you don't, and without leaving anything to his son, he decided he wanted to move to a city. So
it's gone.
So it's gone. And so if you want to document it, if you want to leverage it, if you want to innovate based on it, if you want to use this knowledge effectively and preserve it, there's a danger also in that, because the moment you document it, it's out for all.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And which is why, and so yeah. I think, which is why India has moved very slowly on the proactive step, because the moment they do that, then you're really opening up a minefield. I mean, anyone else can exploit that.
Well, I think they've really done is that they started off by bringing together information that is available anyway, but bringing it all together in one sort of searchable format.
That's it.
But they're not really looking for the sort of local folk knowledge known to a few people.
They would love to do that. They can't do that without internet because, it's difficult to do it, but even if they wanted to do that, you cannot document that. Documenting that would harm the community.
Absolutely, yes. So the community, they wouldn't like it. They'd be very suspicious because a lot of them are as suspicious, if not more so, of governments than they are of companies. They have reason to be suspicious of anybody coming in. So that's it. So yeah, that's very true. Well, thank you.
Of course, illegally, that's in terms of IP, it does raise some new issues, and also people's human rights as well.
Sometimes, some parts of the world, it seems as though the response is for governments to sort of claim ownership of its knowledge, which just doesn't seem right at all.
Canada is trying to do that.
No.
The state that I come from is potentially working in a bill that would say all traditional knowledge within the state belongs to us. And said, you know, this is more of an evil than...
That's more than Monsanto. Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, at least with the patent, you can say it's only for 20 years at the most.
Yeah.
I mean, often less than that because patents lapse, don't keep on paying your fees. So it is a right for a limited time. And though you don't even make any money anyway, so it might just be that, symbolically, it can seem very offensive and annoying. It doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's actually making any money out of it. So it's not a given by any means at all. And as I tried to show, most traditional knowledge does not have an industrial value. Most of it doesn't have any industrial value, which is not to say it doesn't have local value, all right? Because much of it does. But translating that into a science-based product is just tough, and it's the rare exception rather than the norm. It's actually sort of unusual, right? As anything else. What I've tried to argue is that TK is important. It is worth protecting, but mostly because it is important for local people themselves. But it is getting lost, and sadly enough, a lot of it perhaps doesn't have the relevance to people as they adopt urban lifestyles. A lot of it isn't useful anymore, right? In my own country, we've lost nearly all our traditional knowledge because in the 18th century we got virtually forced to go live in cities and work in factories, and it just got lost. So we completely lost touch with our traditional knowledge in Britain. We just lost it. It's not entirely 100%, but it is mostly gone, right? And it will never come back. It's gone. Well, once it's gone, it never comes back. It's gone for good.
And your willow bark is a good example.
Yes.
Willow bark.
That's it. There are a few traces, but not that much. And do people regret that? Not really. Most people don't. It's important, but it doesn't mean it's important all time. It doesn't mean that, and perhaps one shouldn't be too sentimental. It's sad if it happens in your own generation, but in the future generations, they aren't going to look back and think, I wish I could live the way they used to. I wish I had that knowledge. That's not how people think anymore, really. Once you're born in the city, you're glad you're born in the city, I think. Whether you're rich or poor, I suspect most people feel that way. The opportunities and change tend to come in urban areas, and although obviously to India, sort of Punjab, sort of areas of prosperity that have really changed. But for a lot of people, you know, it doesn't change that much from generation to generation, and it's a hard life. I often think when I go to meet an IP in agriculture, and you never see farmers. And why you never see farmers talking? Because they're too busy. They're too busy and they can't afford plane tickets. They're the ones who are working. And that's men in suits. And we think, I work so hard. And we don't really. Yeah, we like to think we do, but we actually get a full night's sleep most of the time. Not this week. But usually we do. We like to think we work really hard, but we actually don't. You know, it's not like if I don't work today, I won't eat tomorrow. You know, I don't have that stress. I talk about stress, you know. Ah, work about it, it's so stressful. It's so stressful being a big professor, you know, it's so stressful being a student. And it's not really. It's not really. We become a bit sort of a bit soft, you know, I think. But farmers, you know, most farmers in the world have really tough lives. They work really hard. We don't really appreciate them much, but you probably should. Any other questions? Yes, please. Yeah.
Even after, like sir was saying, even after you do exploit the proceeds from traditional knowledge, there's the bigger question which you really can't even look at this point, which is, you know, percolating the effects or the monetary benefits of the traditional knowledge which you're exploiting to the community.
Yeah.
How would you effectively distribute the proceeds across the community? Because, you know, they aren't actually the people who invented it.
It's a very good question, which is a sort of cowardly way of saying I don't know how to answer. Well, there is some knowledge that you can trace to a person or to a village. There's some knowledge you can trace to a whole ethnic group, to a whole tribe, but you can't localize it any more than that. There's some traditional knowledge which is, I mean, if you think about, let's say, neem, you know, the neem tree doesn't just grow in India. It grows in subcontinent, it grows actually in Africa as well. There's scientific research being done on neem throughout the world. There's certain knowledge which may be reasonably localized to India or to India and Bangladesh and Nepal and Pakistan. Who owns neem knowledge? Nobody, I would say, really. On the other hand, years ago, I was looking at a case, I'm in Kerala, about this product called Jivani, which is does seem to be known to a fairly limited number of people.
There's a problem there again, because it stretches it's through a forest area.
Yes.
That sort of percolates into Tamil Nadu as well. So
that's
really
right. I went up there as well. Yeah. That's it. It's a lovely area too. Going up there by years ago from Trivandrum, and yes, it crosses boundaries, and also there are, you know, among the Karni there are some who want to make money out of it, and some who don't. They actually don't want any money. Right? So we should lead to some conflicts. A similar case in Southern Africa, the Hudia, the San people who live in about three countries in Southern Africa. There are some organisations who have collected some funds relating to the research, your commercialisation, but the organisations don't necessarily represent all of the people either. So that's very difficult representation as well. Now, one way to look at this is to think that is to do it the way that the FAO is doing with the FAO Treaty on Plant Digital Resources. Now, I'm not sure you know about that, but this is the FAO Treaty on Plant Digital Resources, where governments, countries basically agree to pool their resources, right? But they'll be funding for commercial use, not at the point of getting IP protection, but at the point of commercialising, then some benefit sharing that's what kicks in, particularly if your commercialization is founded on exclusion. The implication being that if you have a pattern linked to it, you're excluding. So commercialization, which involves exclusion, requires you to actually pay something. But, and of course, that is recognition. Not only the fact that countries are basically facilitating access to their own resources, but that those resources have been improved by not just by plant breeders in the modern sense, but also by traditional farmers. Now, how does that money get to its source? Well, again, it's very difficult. But you have a fund, and then that fund should, you know, a bit like a collecting society in terms of copyright, you know. Collecting societies, it does presumably go to individual musicians, composers, authors. This case, you can't do it. So it can be used to fund your development projects and things like this, development projects in certain regions. I mean, it's never going to be an ideal or completely fair system. But so much of knowledge, you cannot anymore localize it to a particular place. So some kind of funding mechanism is needed, perhaps at the point of commercialization as an FAO treaty, rather than the point of getting a patent, which won't make money anyway in most cases, at a point of commercialization, and then start a way to collect the funds and then actually distribute it. Now, how you distribute it isn't very simple, but that is one general approach. But I don't think you're ever going to find a perfect way. And there are some ways where you have, like, the kindly way you can get funds to certain group who are the only ones who know it. But where it's known to a lot of people, if you make a decision that somehow we need to reward and respect and honour communities who live this way, who in a sense are choosing to live that way when there are alternatives that may be less, that may radically transform their lives and will involve loss of this knowledge, there, in a sense, we all make choices, even if we think we aren't. And if we want to honour those choices that they've made to continue to improve plants in the traditional way, then we can support that lifestyle in one way or another through funding, rather than protecting the knowledge of certain people. But we, in a sense, we're honouring a sort of lifestyle that is to all our advantage that people still have that lifestyle. We can't force them to. But we can, perhaps we can make an effort to make that lifestyle a little more pleasant in terms of their material existence, and funding can perhaps help in that way. But you know, getting people to pay for things that they used to get for free, that they've been getting free for the last few thousand years, isn't necessarily. But you know, now you have to pay. People aren't always necessarily very receptive to these, perhaps, you know, possibly rather sort of romantic views about traditional lifestyles. So it's a hard sell, and it's not very easy to do. Sometimes it's relatively easy, other times it's very tricky. But the FAO is actually taking this very seriously. They are really trying very hard to find a way to, and it's working reasonably well, but in terms of getting funding down to the local level, I think there's still some work to do on that yet. Any other questions?
Yes. Can we please thank Graham for his talk, and then you can ask him questions and needs and other things because he's he can be here for another 10 minutes more, and
okay.
We can talk to them more. So can we please thank Graham and show us and show him a bit of our appreciation and your support. Thank you.
Thank you.